there's this idea of it's risky to give people full access to information. Can people really handle the truth? That's pretty paternalistic because, of course, again, people can handle the truth of the fact that they are living with these life-threatening, life-changing diagnoses.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. I've always loved interviewing people. My field research started in grade school when I interviewed a small business owner and someone who had lived through the Great Depression. This love of learning through conversation is one of the main reasons I started The Other 80. And it's been such an honor to bring you deep, surprising, and rich conversations through this podcast. That love of field research and learning through stories is something I deeply share with today's guest. Susanna Fox refers to herself as an incorrigible extrovert. She's the kind of person who might strike up a conversation and learn from anyone, a stranger on the street or a cashier at a store. And that curiosity is on full display in her new book, Rebel Health, a field guide to the patient-led revolution in healthcare. Her life's work has been to explore and map the experience and expertise of patients and caregivers. So please welcome health and technology strategist Susanna Fox to The Other 80. Susanna, it's so wonderful to have you on, and I feel a spiritual connection to your work that we'll dig into as we go forward. So welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I always start with the question, what should the listeners know about you?
People should know that I am an incorrigible extrovert and an irrational optimist. And a mother and a caregiver.
I recently hosted my cousin for a book talk, and she wrote a book on beavers. And what was most delightful was to hear about her field work, which, as you can imagine, occurred in the rivers and streams and trapper conventions of the world. All of these hidden communities that beavers were the center of. And I remember meeting you when you were at Pew and just being kind of enthralled by your research and your field research. And so before we get going, I'd love to hear a bit about how do you approach field research and what's inspiring to you about that?
Well, first I have to say that I had an ancestor who was a beaver trapper. So, and I don't know whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, but he kind of made a fortune during the beaver coat heyday, whenever that was.
He wasn't an aster, was he?
No, he wasn't an aster. I love that you opened with a beaver trapper question and the field work. So I love talking to people. It's often why I need to warn people that I'm an incorrigible extrovert. I'll fall into step with someone walking and interview them, whether they like it or not. I get that from my mom. And it's a superpower in terms of my work as a researcher, because I am so curious about people. And I want to learn from everyone that I meet. And I very luckily had a mentor early on who said, if you are going to try to understand the intersection of healthcare and technology, you need to put down your clipboard, which is the classic, you know, status symbol of a survey researcher, and get out there and just talk to people. Talk to people, especially who are dealing with rare and life-changing diagnoses, because those are the people who are going to use technology in ways that we can't even imagine.
So we're here to hear about a career of insights in this area, but in particular, you recently released a book, Rebel Health, which is profiled in the background beautifully, and also has Cal colors. I just want to point that out. Gold and blue, very on-brand. As a way to introduce folks to the concept, I'd love to have you share one or two stories from the book that really bring to life what you are so passionate about, what you've been writing about.
Thank you for that invitation. I'll start by talking about diabetes, because the Diabetes Rebel Alliance represents the full stack of the patient-led revolution. And that means that they are people who, to the outsider, it would appear that diabetes is kind of a solved problem in healthcare, in that we can diagnose it. There are treatments for it. There are even some really wonderful devices to help people manage it. And yet, if you are within that community, especially the type 1 or insulin requiring diabetes community, you know that it is not at all a solved problem. People were very frustrated with the clunky technology that they were given, much less the expense of it. My focus is on the social impact of technology. So I don't have much officially to say about the financial aspect. I just want to get that out of the way, because that's not my research. My research is on how patients and caregivers and survivors are innovating. So basically what the community did was rally around this idea of, we are not waiting. We are not waiting for the industry to solve this. We are not waiting for the government to solve this. We're going to take this into our own hands. For example, they hacked into their own continuous glucose monitors to free the data that, by the way, was being generated by their own bodies. Medical device companies had only ever seen clinicians as their customers, because those are the people who are prescribing the devices. They didn't actually see the patients and caregivers as their end users and customers until the rebels took back that power, demanded access to that data, and changed the game for diabetes. So in the lexicon of Rebel Health, there were seekers, people who go out on the hunt for something better and they don't give up. There were networkers, people who, once they find something, they disperse it all across the world and they learn in community. There were solvers, people who can't wait to take something apart and learn about it and put it back together again. And there were champions, people who have access to mainstream resources, that they recognize a patient-led team that has got a scrappy new idea and they help them take it to scale.
And I love how that framework does a beautiful job of embedding this expertise in something that could be recognizable to a policymaker or to a product developer, so they can go out and look for those folks. There's so many of our friends in the example, so I kind of feel like I'd love to talk about all of them and have them here at the party. Sarah Rigar is one of the people you talk about in your book. And I know I met Sarah at an amazing conference we both used to attend called Medicine X at Stanford. And Sarah has, I don't know if it was a book or a brochure with a graphic on the front. And the graphic had a bunch of blue dots and then one single red dot. And I'd love to have you talk about Sarah and what is the meaning of that graphic.
That graphic represents all of the hours in a year that Sarah manages her own Parkinson's disease. And the one red dot is the 1 hour that she spends with her neurologist. And Sarah draws our attention to this potential, not in terms of scarcity, but in terms of abundance. The abundance of wisdom that patients have about their own bodies, about their own symptoms and conditions, that they frankly have to learn. So Sarah engages in what's called personal science, in that she tracks her own symptoms very carefully so that she can set up systems, for example, time her medications, to alleviate the symptoms of Parkinson's. She does some really cool things, like she'll wear a knee pad only on one knee because she does fall sometimes, and she tries to remember to fall on the side where she's wearing a knee pad. But actually wearing the knee pad actually makes her fall less. She's tracked this because in knowing that she would be okay if she fell, it actually gives her confidence to walk with power. So that's an example of how she is very careful about the medicine side of Parkinson's, but also the sort of mind games that we all play with ourselves and how she leverages that.
And it's, I think, one of the themes you draw out that I've certainly seen in some of the people I know is the super users, I guess a term used a lot in product development, but the people kind of at the horizon who are doing things that might then inform all of our lives. And you talk a lot about rare disease patients. Can you pull out that theme a little bit more about how those alpha expert patients are really showing us what's possible?
Absolutely. So we know this in product design, that if you design something for the extreme, then it'll be useful for everyone. I actually learned that early on in the 90s when I was coming up. I was building websites, and I would take my laptop over to Baltimore and show my grandmother, who was in her 80s, what I was designing. And if my grandmother couldn't navigate it, then I would go back to the design team and say, we need to change this. And that's an example of how you design for an extreme. And in healthcare, we often find that things that start out on the margins eventually move into the mainstream. Things that are built by pioneers on the frontiers of science, we end up getting there, whether it's 5 or 10 or 20 years later. You know, we're all now talking about genetic testing. People living with rare disease were talking about that 10 and 15 years ago. We're all now talking about having access to our full medical record. People living with rare disease demanded that because they needed it. We just had a Rare Disease Day, and one of my favorite events of the year, I try to go every year, is Rare Disease Day at the National Institutes of Health. And they call them binder moms. They actually call themselves binder moms, moms of kids with rare disease, because they have their full medical record. And so the more that healthcare can pay attention to the pioneers and the rebels, the people who look to us like they are rare, the better we can respond to everyone. And the one other thing that I like to say about rare disease is two other things. One is rare diseases are actually quite common. There are very few people who have a certain rare disease, but there are millions of people who have rare diseases, millions. The other thing is that when you have a new diagnosis, you're likely to feel alone because it's happening to you and you feel rare in that moment, even if it's something that's common. And my message to people is, you are not alone. There are people out there who would love to help you if only they knew how to find you. And that's something that we've learned from the rare disease communities.
Going back to your anecdote about walking up to people on the street and talking to each other, I love how your personality and values and incredible traits are reflected in this beautiful research that shows the value of community. And in the biggest possible context, we all know that community is slipping away in so many areas of our lives. So this is a gorgeous example of the importance of that and also how we can go about building that.
Can I say something, though?
There's
something there that I frankly got kind of a comeuppance when I was doing some of my interviews, because people said, hey, listen, you are an extrovert. I am not. I don't want to join a community. And so it was actually very interesting to me to meet seekers and solvers, for example, who are not networkers. They said, I have no interest in joining a community. You don't have to become a networker, but you can recruit a networker to your team if the problem you're trying to solve needs a networker on your team.
One of the interviews I did over the last few months was with Dr. Pooja Mittal, who's the Chief Health Equity Officer at HealthNet. And we had this fascinating conversation about grievance data. And she said, Claudia, there are so many product examples in grievance data. And of course, we have to respond to those and try to make it better and figure it out. But she said, that's a goldmine of information about people's experience with what we're putting out there. And we've just gotten so much out of that. And I loved your example of Amazon review data as these mini pop-up communities of patients around a particular topic or product or whatever. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's something I actually just stumbled into, you know, doing my own shopping on Amazon. I started noticing like, wait, there are thousands of reviews here. And so I started doing some investigation and seeing people wanting to testify for or against a product and to be very specific, you know, talking about, for example, a pill box and saying this pill box would be good if you are setting up pills in advance for someone who's going to keep this, you know, on the bathroom counter or on their bedside table. This pill box is not good if it's going to be in your purse or backpack because it opens easily. And so they were saying, this is my use case. This is how I use it. And this is how it has worked or has failed me. And seeing how much people were responding to each other in those, as they say, these pop-up peer groups, it made me realize how Amazon, whether they like it or not, has become a health information exchange, very different from the health information exchanges that you and I have talked about in the past. But this idea that it's a public forum, and we see it in product reviews, book reviews, all over the place, and it has created this expectation that we should be able to learn from one another in every aspect of our lives.
One of the titles you have, I love, is Ambassador from the Future, which I imagine comes with a different outfit, but in any case. And so if you were an ambassador from the future describing how it was that researchers, people running medical education and health systems had figured this out, what would that look like?
We got a preview of the way that research could be patient-led during the pandemic, when it was patients with long COVID who identified long COVID, fielded a survey to document the symptoms, got that published, got recognition in The Lancet, and then from the NIH and the CDC and the WHO. And what I love about the patient-led research collaborative for long COVID is that these were individuals who had some research background, who were knocked down by a crisis, and they did not let that crisis go to waste. They not only did this research and helped the world to recognize a secondary effect of the pandemic, they also documented how they did it. And so there are now scorecards, and maybe we can link in the show notes to these scorecards, where they talk about how clinicians and researchers, patients, survivors, and caregivers can all work together in an equal partnership, a truly equal partnership. And I was very mindful in the subtitle of the book to use the word patient-led and not patient-centered. Patient-centered, it's fine, but what I really saw in my fieldwork is the strength when we actually flip the power structure, and that's the future. The future is that we give more power to patients. We involve them, for example, at the beginning of a research project. We don't present them with, these are the questions that we're going to ask, or even worse, these are the results of the questions that we have asked. What do you think? In the future, and as I say, I'm an ambassador from the future. I'm just here to tell you what's going to happen. You can choose to believe me or not. But in the future, people who are living with the condition or physical challenge, whatever it is, they are the ones who are going to be involved in the design of clinical trials. They're going to be designing the research that solves the problems that they are living with.
I don't know if you remember at Medicine X, there was a pharma company that had designed a workshop to get feedback on an app, and the app was going to allow people to participate in clinical trials more remotely. And boy, did they get a schooling on so many questions around why are you even studying this particular thing that you're studying? Like, I'm not going to look at your app. Did you involve any patients in your app? Apparently not. What about this piece? And I just remember that team, to their credit, remained so open to the feedback. And in fact, engaged one of those patients to help them rethink their whole approach after. Do you remember that?
I remember that panel. It was one of those Medicine X moments where it feels like a tinderbox and you don't know which way it's going to go. And what I loved is one of the leaders of the pharma company said, I receive that. They didn't try and defend themselves. They just said, I receive that. And that to me is leadership, to have the confidence to know that you're there to learn and to change your mind and to admit what you don't know. To me, that's true leadership.
So for a leader that wanted to move towards the future you're describing in a positive way, what might be some first steps they could take?
The first step that I would take is to recognize that you may not know everything about the healthcare market that you are working in, to seek new sources of insight and new sources of data. So the first thing is just to acknowledge that you might not know everything and to begin by listening, looking for people who are asking unexpected questions. You also really need to get way down deep in the hierarchy, get to the people who are on the front lines of whatever business you're in, go to the call center, listen in on the calls in the call center, read those Amazon reviews, go out into the community that you serve and really listen to people and then move from there.
Interesting. I remember an anecdote from a physician. He was an oncologist and he said one day a person came in with the equivalent of the binders, bags and bags of paper. And he said, what are those? And she said, those are all the articles about my condition that I've read. And he was starting to move into kind of a reactive mode, like, uh-oh. Because he realized in that moment, he hadn't read those articles. Maybe he'd read one or two, but she had bags of articles. And he said, I had to really quiet my nervous system. And I just said, what is it you want from me? And she said, I know this information, but I can't always interpret it. Could you help be my interpreter? In this world of abundance of information, and you talk in the book about the number of journals, there is no way that a clinician is going to have read all of the articles. And quite possibly, and most likely, they've read fewer than a very active patient who's studying their own condition. So I love that even taking a moment to think, what is my role shifting to? There must be a little bit of mourning of like, I liked it when I was the expert. And I'm thinking about medical training, like how might we train clinicians in a way in that curiosity and openness and even the process of helping a patient in a more partnered way figure out what they want to do. What shared decision-making often is I've come up with two options and you need to decide. And I think what you're talking about is, no, the patients come up with five options and they just want some help figuring it out.
And I think that touches on something that's important to recognize the diversity of the population that someone might be serving, because there are still people who just want to be told what to do.
Right.
There are people who say, I'm exhausted. I'm stunned. I don't have time for this. Just tell me what to do. I'm fine with the doctor being in charge. And there are people who are seekers, and there are people who are networkers who have gone out and read all those articles or joined an expert patient community and learned absolutely everything. And a clinician's opportunity is to find out what kind of patient they are working with that day. Does that patient want the power structure to stay the same as it ever was? Or do they want a guide? Do they want a partner? And recognizing that there are so many different kinds of people, I think is really important.
One of the topics you talk about a lot that's also a shared passion of mine is data liberation. One of the things I've discovered in my work on data sharing is the extent to which data is a bastion of control. And sometimes that's control over business, over dollars. Sometimes that's control over truth. Sometimes it's just control over technology and infrastructure and things like that. And I love so many examples in your book of data liberation and kind of how it challenges that framework. I'll name a couple, but you could talk about others like Collective, Night Scout, Open Notes as all examples of that. Can you talk a little bit about the underlying dynamics of data and how that works and what are the needs for patients? And some of these really, I think, quite intriguing examples of how patients liberated data.
Something that I really appreciate about today's radical health movements, they are building on these foundations that were often metaphorically dug by hand by people of radical health movements of the past. And data liberation is one of those. What's important to notice is how many different kinds of data there are. So, for example, you talked about the Light Collective that began with people who have the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, that is known to have a higher likelihood of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And they were defending the right for people to have privacy and security around that data and for corporations not to own a patent on that data. That's how it began. And their work is centered on this idea that, of course, patients and survivors should be the stewards of their own data. They should have full access to their own data. And that means all of the privacy and security around that versus Night Scout, which is the diabetes device liberation movement, freeing the data from the devices that help someone manage their diabetes. That was basically started because a diabetes dad, a D-dad, hacked into his son's continuous glucose monitor, freed the data, shared it on Twitter, and a worldwide group started, the Night Scout Foundation, where people were essentially creating homemade DIY ways to track their kids and their own blood sugar. And then there's the Open Notes movement, which is about the ability to get access to our clinical record, to the doctor's notes that have traditionally been seen as the property of the doctor. And in fact, these are incredibly useful notes for a patient to have access to. And in each case, we're flipping the power structure so that people have access to the data they need to take care of themselves and the people they love. And if that isn't the point of healthcare, then I don't know what is. Again, hearkening back to Sarah's diagram, that 364 days of the year, we're caring for ourselves. And so why shouldn't we have full access to data and full confidence that no one else is looking at the data without our permission?
Many people know HIPAA as its privacy and security underpinnings, but an equal leg of that stool is creating a legal framework under which patients have a right to their healthcare data, which doesn't necessarily exist for other data that's not covered by HIPAA. So it's an interesting protective place. And the Office of Civil Rights has taken a lot of pretty ambitious moves to update their interpretation of that as times have changed. So previously, 30 days was the amount of time. They're trying to figure out how to say, in these days of real-time data, that is not the right standard. So it's a really interesting example of, an agency over several administrations trying to push the boundaries to update the framework for the modern age and preserve the underpinning of that, which is that patients should have full access to their data. When you were talking, I was thinking about what I've often heard, and you've probably often heard, which is that, isn't it risky for a patient to hack their glucose monitor? Is it risky for a patient to have their data? And I sort of find myself getting a little riled up whenever I hear that. I love to situate that in a person's life where their needs are not being met by the products or by their clinicians. It's life and death. Like in the case of Night Scout, one of the clinical origins of that was this risk of dying in your sleep if you don't get alerted appropriately for low blood sugar. So I guess I'd just love to hear your thoughts a little bit about this reaction that patient innovation is risky. And there must be cases where that is 100% true. And but also, I think it's a power reaction to the way we're used to the world being.
I will quote my friends in the Diabetes Rebel Alliance who would say, living with diabetes is risky. And what we are trying to do is reduce the risk by getting access to our data, because indeed, what you're describing is a terrible name. It's dead in bed syndrome, nocturnal hypoglycemia, where your blood sugar, if you have insulin requiring diabetes, your blood sugar goes low in the middle of the night, and you don't wake up. And the way that a lot of parents with kids with type 1 diabetes live with this, if by the way, if they're lucky enough to have for their kid to have a continuous glucose monitor, the way that they had to live was to set alarms every 2 hours. Somebody, a parent or guardian, had to stumble down the hallway into the kid's bedroom and peer into the dark to see the screen, because the data was on the device only, and to see if the kid's blood sugar was in range. So it's like having a newborn for more than a decade. Can you imagine? And Dana Lewis is an activist and an advocate in this area, a friend of ours. And she actually wrote, she's a very deep sleeper, and her continuous glucose monitor's alarm was not loud enough to wake her up. And so she wrote to the device manufacturers to ask them to make a louder alarm. And they said, the alarm is loud enough. They ignored the possibility that they could improve their product based on this important user feedback. And it was thanks to John Kostick, the D-dad who freed the data from his son CGM, that Dana was able to create a DIY louder alarm for herself. And in that case, she's reducing the risk of living with diabetes and creating the tool that she needs for herself. So diabetes is a great example because they've had such success. They've actually had success at the policy level. They've had success in changing the minds of the CEOs of device companies. But I want to talk about an example of someone who has not had success, and that's Hugo Campos, who lives with an ICD, lives with a pacemaker essentially. And he also wants access to his data. But because there's not as large of a grassroots community movement around it, he's been kind of the lone voice in talking about this. And it's a very interesting question, the sociology of a radical health movement. You know, we all love that video of it's not just the first dancer, it's actually the second dancer that gets the crowd up and dancing. So, you know, you think of Hugo, Hugo's that one dancer on the hill asking for his cardiac device data. You know, interesting reasons. There isn't a social movement as there was with diabetes. Switching gears, though, I think there's another risk that a lot of people talk about, and there's this idea of it's risky to give people full access to information, that, you know, can people really handle the truth? That's pretty paternalistic, because, of course, again, people can handle the truth of the fact that they are living with these life-threatening, life-changing diagnoses. Why not empower them to read a medical journal article or get someone in their friends and family network who can read it for them and help them understand its implications for themselves? What I also want to say is the patient revolution can help fight against misinformation and disinformation if we give everyone full access to science. The networkers can help us spread the truth. If we empower people with science, if we empower people with the skills of fact-checking, we can actually leverage this underground movement for the betterment of society.
And to me, that I know one of the things is, how do you make sure that federally funded research ends up in open source places, not just the studies, but also the data? Progress has been made, but obviously there's still a lot behind paywalls, or only positive results getting shared, not negative results. So I think this puts that in such beautiful context, because that often feels like very geeky science policy stuff, but that has huge implications for our ability to understand our own conditions, especially if they're rare.
The American people have paid for this research, right? I mean, the American people have paid for it, right? So if, and it is true that the current policy, NIH, if you're funded by an NIH grant, you are required to publish open access after 1 year. But for 1 year, there's a possibility of exclusivity and a paywall.
And that might be when you needed that for a life-saving treatment.
Exactly.
I loved the care with which you talked about misinformation in the book. You mentioned that clinicians can be a touch point that can help mediate information. But I think we also talked about earlier how often the clinicians haven't read the articles and they don't have time to answer your emails, right? So I think this idea of having the network be part of the arbiter is so interesting. And you gave some examples in the book of the swarming of bad information. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, these are some of my favorite studies because there are multiple. So one of the studies is of a breast cancer forum where there were thousands of messages posted and just a handful, less than a dozen, and contained bad advice or misinformation. And of course, we know that misinformation is a mistake. Disinformation is on purpose. So these were examples of misinformation. Somebody was posting something they'd heard about breast cancer or treatment. And in a healthy online forum, the community can act as if it has a strong immune system and the antibodies rise up against a threat, such as bad advice or misinformation. And those posts were either taken down or corrected within a few hours. And there were only a handful that were allowed to persist that the community had missed and were allowed to persist. So there's always a fraction of danger in there, which is why we all need to fact check and before we start a treatment, check with a clinician. If you join a healthy community, one that is active, vibrant, has many members posting many postings a day, you are more likely to be dipping your cup into a river of truth and a river of good advice. But still, drink with caution.
One of the things I loved you said in the book was if this patient expertise and network were a product, it would fly off the shelves. I'm not aware of companies that have formed or products that have formed around patient networks in a non-clinical trial context. Do you see a market in this space? And if so, what does that market look like?
I have to believe that there's a market for this because we see it happening, for example, on Twitter. We see it happening on Reddit. We see it happening on Facebook. We see it happening on Instagram. We see it happening on YouTube. There are communities of people connecting with each other, sometimes short-term, sometimes long-term, everywhere. And I have not yet lost hope that there is a business model here that could sustain, one where the moderators are paid and supported because the work of the moderators for these communities is so important, and people burn out without support. So I really believe that there is a use case.
With our time almost over, I'll close with the question that I've been asking everyone, and this is my extroverted get free advice part of the conversation. So I recently joined the Berkeley School of Public Health in a role to focus on social impact. And the way we talk about it is that universities have always focused on education and research. But the third question is, how do you make that make a difference in the world? Whether that's from a policymaking standpoint, creating bigger and broader platforms of solving, similar to what we did in the Obama administration, and shrinking the distance between praxis, between the field and the generation of knowledge. Every guest has brought such incredible insights. What would be your insights about what I could focus on and how to go about doing that work?
I bet you're already doing it, but get out into the community, sit on a park bench, listen to community members about what they see as the project of public health, and learn from people in the community about what they need. Start there, and not only model that for the students, but actually ask the students to do the same thing, so that from the very beginning of their careers in public health, they are, as I said at the beginning, put down that clipboard and listen.
Thank you so much. Everyone should read Rebel Health. I think it'll bring a whole nother level of possibility into your thinking about the future of health. Susanna, thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Such a pleasure. Great to see you.
This conversation really connected a lot of dots for me. Part of what I'm trying to do on this podcast is lay out the pathways for how we might share power with and learn from the expertise and experience of people closest to the pain. Many guests on the show have talked about building voice and sharing power as pathways to better health. For Tony Eitan, it was about sharing power with communities in California. Jen Palka discussed tapping the experience and voice of people using government services. And for Susanna, it's about embracing patient rebels. And that means new and different roles for those of us who have traditionally held power: public health officials, doctors, health plan executives, and policymakers. And so I invite us to lean into these questions. What new role am I being invited into? And how can I share power and build voice to create health in America? This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Susanna Fox and her book, Rebel Health. There's more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.